the Window, a podcast about dining in the South and beyond. I'm Robert Moss, the author of Barbecue, the History of American Institution.
And I'm Hannah Raskin, food editor at the Post and Courier.
Today we're doing the We Chef edition of the Window. That's we as in yes, because we're talking about chefs, particularly chefs here in the city of Charleston, because there's been, we can say, quite a lot of changes and movements on the chef scene here in just really in the past couple of weeks or months. I think we'll start the big news, I think, which sort of sparked this is the announcement that Sean Brock has sort of formally parted ways with the Neighborhood Dining Group, restaurant group that he got started with at McCrady's, then launched Husk here in Charleston, and then the burgeoning Husk Empire in Nashville, Savannah, Greenville, if I can remember them all, and also Monero, Brock's taco spot here, and the announcement came down, I guess it was a week or two ago, and sort of, he's still sort of somehow involved with Husk through some, I think it's his ownership arrangement, but he's not going to be actively involved in the day-to-day anymore. He's launching out on his own, but not here in Charleston either. It's up the road a bit.
Right, and I think what's important to note about this is it's essentially formalizing a relationship that already existed, yeah, in that we had not seen Sean in Charleston for a long time.
Yeah, he's moving to Nashville.
I think the metaphor you alluded to earlier is apt. It's sort of like if your parents separate, you're not going to notice when the divorce decree comes
through.
You know, and it's sort of like that. This is sort of a legal, statement.
And the official announcement. I think also he announced he's got some things in the works in Nashville, so maybe it was time for him to be able to talk about those or whatever.
Right. I mean, I think what's interesting is, so what I just said is known to people who follow food closely or get paid to follow food like we do, but people who didn't know that. And so almost every time I go into Husk Bar, there's some tourist saying, is Sean here tonight?
Yeah. Right? And absolutely, I mean, because he was the face of Husk, and,
right?
And or maybe the arm of Husk, because his tattoo sleeve, yeah, arm was featured very prominently almost any article that anybody ever did about Husk. It was,
yep,
that arm holding some kind of plate with some beautiful Southern food on it. So yeah, literally, he was the face and the arm of Husk since its opening days.
Right. So I think there was some sort of, this seemed more tumultuous, I feel like, to those outside, yeah, of the dining scene. For those who, again, follow the dining scene closely, actually it was the departure of the Chef de Cuisine from The Ordinary that was the bigger news from the same week, because Vandy is really talented and responsible for some great dishes. And I think frequently when tourists do go home from Charleston and they talk about, oh my God, something blew my mind, it's more likely Vandy had his hands, yep, on it.
So, and Vandy is who again for those?
Vandy Vanderwerker.
Vanderwerker, right?
And so he actually has a real first name, but I can't recall what it is.
Vandy to everyone. Yep. And what was his departure? Has he announced where he's going?
It's not said yet where he's going, but we will keep listeners updated.
But is he staying here in town? Did he say that much?
I saw on Instagram he just got engaged.
Okay.
So congratulations.
He may be taking an entirely different,
yep,
different, yep, path in his life.
Yeah.
Obviously, with Brock officially leaving Charleston and announcing it, it's led to some, a lot of pondering and speculation and looking back over the time since he's been here. And really, it's always good to do that, I think, every now and again, because you forget how much and how quickly things change in the dining scene and in the South in general, but particularly here in Charleston. And Brock started at McCrady's not really all that long ago, 2006. So, and effectively had about a solid decade here in Charleston before he really started moving, spending much more time in Nashville and moving mm-hmm. out of here. And the food scene here has changed dramatically since then. And he was obviously one of the driving forces behind it. I don't know. Did you do any of these retrospective?
I did not. No. I didn't do that. I actually suggested that we hire you to write one of those. Money wasn't in the budget. So the reason I didn't is because I wasn't here.
Yeah,
at my fee
is just. It's,
yeah,
just,
it's too high.
Astronomical.
Right. No, I didn't do that, but I know that there was some pushback when his departure, in the wake of his departure, his time here was characterized as revolutionary.
Yeah.
Again, this has nothing to do with Sean's talent, but I wonder if what was more, and you tell me, you were here, what was more instrumental for moving the dining scene forward was not just particularly what Sean was cooking, although that was great, but the idea that we're going to go find the best and brightest, and we're going to staff our restaurant with someone who's fantastic. Glenn Roberts was a recruiter too, you know, and I just wonder if David Howard, and well, I guess he was hired prior to Neighborhood Dining Group, actually. A few weeks before.
It was right before the transition when the Neighborhood Dining Group bought McCrady's from the prior owner.
Yeah, but and so I just wonder if there's more credit at the ownership level that maybe.
I think it's at many, many levels. And it's like any kind of like flourishing movement in food, but also in the arts, music, anything like that. You know, it's a whole bunch of talented people, energetic people getting together, and usually in one place. Mm-hmm. You know, it's even in the days of social media and all this hyperconnectivity, there's still something about being geographically, physically in the same place, hanging out with each other and all that. And Sean definitely was a very instrumental player in Charleston's transformation, but he wasn't by any means the sole player, and certainly by no means wasn't the guy who got it started at all. You know, but if you think about 2006 when he started at McCrady's, and this is really about the time when I first started doing restaurant reviews in Charleston. I think it's like less than 6 months after he came is when I first started writing a lot of restaurant reviews. Mm-hmm. You know, at that time, Charleston's cuisine was largely just the couple blocks there on East Bay Street where McCrady's restaurant still is today, and slightly north of Broad is just up the block, and the High Cotton and Magnolia's and Blossom there. So it's just sort of this strip of restaurants there. That was the scene. Mm-hmm.
Well, Peninsula Grill.
And the Peninsula Grill, which was really sort of, well, is up a little bit, but right around the corner on the market. Yeah. Right. So you go up Market Street. Yeah. So you have these two streets, mm-hmm. Peninsula Grill, and then you had Charleston Place. Up further at the market. So you had this little L of streets that you could walk from one to the other. Upper King Street up above Calhoun was nothing at that point in terms of fine dining. There was, you know, some cafes and stuff, but there was no fine dining things. That's all changed. But and Brock started off doing like the molecular gastronomy stuff, a lot of foams and gastriques, and we were writing about him at the city paper in 2007. It was really all about sort of this, you know, science kid wizard kind of stuff, but he was one of a couple of people. There was a restaurant called Cordavi that was doing similar kind of stuff. But then you had folks like Frank Lee at Slight North Abroad. You had Mike Latta at Fig. You had Anson Restaurant, which is where Glenn Roberts of Anson Mills sort of was. I don't know what he did. He was a recruiter there. He did a variety of things for them. He wasn't a chef, but he did a lot of ingredients. But you had people like Latta. You had people like Nico Romo, who's at Fish Restaurant. Had Ben Berryhill, who is at Red Drum in Mount Pleasant. They really got into the fresh local fish and really got that whole thing started. You know, Brock came along and found the fish and fell in love with it too and helped promote it, but he wasn't the first one by any means. He sort of picked up on what these other folks had done. Frank Lee, can't underestimate his influence on pushing Southern ingredients, local ingredients, those types of things. Mike Latta, veggie boy, as they used to call him at one point, was one of the few chefs when he first got into Charleston who actually would go to the farmers markets and cultivate local farmers and things that everyone did. Brock just sort of came into that scene with his energy and passion. And if you know anything about him, he's like obsessively passionate about things. We got super obsessive about vegetables, super obsessive about the fish, and then helped drive it forward from there.
But as you say, he was here before he was at McCrady. So he also was learning from these guys. And I think that part's important too, because as you look around now, you talk about the short staffing and the, you know, chefs jumping from one place to another. I don't know that there are as many anchor points as there were when he was here.
Yeah, and we were talking a few episodes ago with about Johnson and Wales. Mm-hmm. So, and you know, Johnson and Wales had the culinary school here, right here in downtown Charleston, and so many people. And I think Brock came through Johnson and Wales, so he got his sort of formal education there. I know he went to then work with Robert Carter at Peninsula Grill, which at the time was, well, still is, a sort of very flashy, high end, super luxurious restaurant, and he sort of learned from Bob Carter and got inculcated in that. And yeah, so definitely, you know, there was it wasn't in spring fully formed from
exactly,
the earth.
Right.
It was groomed by all the other things that were happening here in Charleston.
Now, in y'all's perception, how would you compare the dining scenes in like Charleston and Nashville?
Charleston and Nashville?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to say. Gosh,
like do you the way you were just describing like Charleston maturing over the years that you've seen it? Like, do you feel like do you think that like Nashville is a
Nashville
less?
Nashville has gone through that process, and I think gone through it more quickly. Really,
yeah.
I mean, it. I don't think, because that was a place that 20 years ago there was nothing to eat in Nashville, and I'm sure that someone will correct me that there were some great chefs working there. But when I used to go to Nashville, there wasn't much.
No,
and so
there
as you
wasn't.
Say, even in Charleston, even if it wasn't necessarily revolutionary, 20 years ago, you could still find a decent meal. I mean, it might not have been.
Yeah, no, Charleston had its first when all those restaurants on East Bay Street came along. And,
right.
And sort of became, you know, they put shrimp and grits on the map.
Yep.
Frankly, was a big part of that. Donald Berrickman, Gnolias was a big part of all that movement. So Charleston did have sort of like that was a first wave. And then when Brock sort of came along around 2006 through up till 2011 when Husk opened, that was sort of like the second wave of this new Southern cuisine. My impression of Nashville, and I had the benefit of being on the inside and going to all the restaurants and going to a lot of the events and sort of seeing it happen firsthand in Charleston. Nashville, much more I parachute in there every now and again and sample things. There was a point, and this is about the time that Charleston was booming. I think Nashville had a handful of sort of pioneering chefs and restaurants that were sort of tapping into that same kind of, you know, hyper Southern, hyper local vibe. There was Tandy Wilson, who was at the City House. Tyler Brown was a chef at the Capitol Grill at the Hermitage Hotel, which is actually where Sean Brock was before he came down to Charleston. So Brock had actually been there.
The second time he
left Charleston, went up to Nashville, maybe bounced a little bit more, and then came back to take over at McCready's. But Tyler Brown was there, and I think they have their own farm. They raise their own beef, so a lot of that kind of – but they didn't have a lot. They had a handful of people. And then Cat Birdseed came along. But then all of a sudden it just exploded. And I think what happens is – well, I think Nashville was helped by the country music scene and Music City and all that. It was a cool place to be, and it drew a lot of young, passionate people. They have a thriving, taco truck scene and just general food scene. I think this drew a lot of people together, and I think they finally got that we might call a critical mass necessary to start spinning out a lot of really interesting restaurants. But it seems to have developed in a very different way than Charleston did. Charleston seemed to me, at least, it developed much more on the high end, much more fine dining, as opposed to this flourishing of just sort of that whole the food truck kind of thing. All that came later, you know.
Right. So they and Nashville has inherited restaurants from us, and that hasn't happened the other way around, right?
That's right.
They got Husk Nashville. They got Butcher and Bee. I thought there was someone else who was opening in Nashville, but in any case,
so let me I guess just kind of set up the way I've been thinking about this and get y'all's take. When we first got the news, I think like in my social circle, the hot take was like, oh, this is terrible for Charleston. Like,
right.
What a loss. Like, this is the headline name, right? And then the more I thought about it, the more I thought, well, kind of. There's so many restaurants now. Like, it's not – I don't know why necessarily our image of Charleston dining is so dominated by this one figure. It's actually kind of saturated. And so what I'm wondering is, like, is there maybe more opportunity in Nashville to be a big name? Like, is Charleston kind of getting full?
No, Nashville has plenty of big names. But here are two takeaways from that. One, I think, as I said, those who know dining in Charleston weren't especially concerned. It was those who didn't know who were. And I think people who don't keep on top of these things, unless they live in Charleston, they don't even know he left.
Yeah.
I don't think it's really going to make a difference in the national scene because they're not going to have gotten word about, I mean, this is a very inside baseball sort of thing. So I don't think it's going to damage us, you know, in terms of tourism campaigns. And again, they've kept him as a culinary advisor. I did look to see like if Sean had done much work with the CBB, if they were going to have to like revise their ad campaigns. I think all is good. But I do want go say more on these ad campaigns, because this idea about him being the face of Charleston or the arm of Charleston or wherever the heck he is, I mean, that whole restaurant group really set a standard for PR in this town. I mean, they took PR to a new level. And that may be what they did as much as anything else. I mean, it really, now a restaurant does not open in Charleston without a publicist. And I mean, you were here before I was, but I'm going to guess that in 06, that was not
and,
the case.
And actually, Gimmer, you're saying that made me really think about sort of the progression of Charleston on from like a national scene. Because in 2006, 2007, when Brock was just getting started, you had like this really great dining community, the restaurants we were all talking about, but they didn't get a huge amount of attention from the national press. Was it Craig Claiborne wrote it was Johnny Apple. Wrote from New York Times, wrote a piece about Charleston Star Rising somewhere around that same time that Brock arrived. And So it got a little bit of attention, and people started getting, you know, picking up on it. But that was sort of like the in crowd. And but the dynamic of Husk's opening in 2011 was just incredible at the time, like before it opened.
Yep.
6 months before it opened, the social media and the PR started. And you had obviously people locally, you know, were doing the breathless. I think this is about the time Eater was getting started and all that, mm-hmm. was doing the, you know, round the clock Husk watch, you know, what's Brock doing? But it was people from outside the town, you know, that were picking up on it. And Husk really just hit the market at the time when the New York press in particular was just all of a sudden really fascinated and excited about Southern food. Mm-hmm. And so you had this very charismatic, telegenic young chef who made like all kinds of just declarative statements like, I'm never cooking, you know anything.
Southern, it comes through the door.
Everything's from the South. I'm never cooking steak again or something like, you know, just crazy things.
Right.
That would throw down the gauntlet about how Southern he was. And it just absolutely blew up because it was like the press and the media, they were waiting for the hyper-Southern person to come along, and Brock stepped up and then Husk was it. And then suddenly that's boom. That's when people all over, you know, New York were putting warm bread and Benton's bacon on their menus.
But I would say in terms of Sean Brock's personal enduring influence, that tasting room should have been a bigger success if he was what was drawing everybody, right? And I'm not speaking to the quality of food at this point. I'm just saying the fact that you can get a reservation almost anytime you want.
Well, I would say even before that, because I had the privilege of – I think I did the very first published review of Husk that mm-hmm. wasn't – you know, it was actually on a piece of paper as opposed to, you know, somebody's you know, blog or something with the city paper. And then I did the first, I think, review of Monero. And which is, you know, Brock's sort of, I think that was, you know, that was the next one he did after Husk. It was this taco concept, you know, sort of all hype, same idea, which he got all super hyper passionate about Southern food. So he did the same thing about Mexican food and was open his Mexican place. And it didn't get much of a blip from anything outside of Charleston.
Well, I got a lot of attention when I asked D. Heck if those silverware drawers were allowed.
But not in New York. He didn't.
No.
The only people who ended up caring about Monero opening were people in Charleston. And
with good reason. It's a solid restaurant.
Well,
I was just there recently.
I go there all the time.
I think this is like the jewel in the crown, to be honest.
And unlike Husk, which blew up, you couldn't get in. You could walk into Monero just about any time, grab a table, and just have the best tacos and beans.
It is delicious.
And,
yeah. I mean, it is really – I think Monero is really where they got it right.
And I love Monero because it isn't a big night out kind of thing. You can just go in there and grab lunch. And,
right.
You
know. And
my friends and I use it as a verb to get Monero'd is when you are just blown away by something that you didn't expect at all. Yes.
Right? Yeah. You know, people are apologetic to me. They're like, well, I kind of like Monero. Like, of course you should like Monero. Yeah, and it's funny. But you're right. It just doesn't have that same sort of attention.
I got so excited because I wanted to be the first person to get the review out.
Yeah.
And I went online. I was expecting like nobody – tweet. No, nobody cared outside of Charleston.
Maybe my review came out first.
No. Mine was first. I remember.
No.
It doesn't really matter either way because I was just expecting there to be like the guy from the New York Times would come down or the guy from the Washington Post, but nope. It just sort of flew under the radar. And then you mentioned then Brock, of course, after a while retooled McCrady's into his whole two concepts as a hyper, super, almost back to his molecular gastronomy tasting menu and then more the big format. Tavern and it didn't get a whole lot of notice either.
Nope.
And I think that goes to, you know, I think it's because the world wanted super Southern chef boy,
right?
And they found it in Brock.
Yep.
They didn't want the guy making tacos.
Yep.
They didn't want the guy doing yet another tasting menu because people in Chicago and New York do that. So that was. So I think it does sort of speak to it. It wasn't this, you know. Yeah, it wasn't something inherent in the way Brock cooks. It was much more in the image and what he represented. And he's a brilliant, like I say, with Monero, a brilliant cook.
Right. No, this has nothing to do with his aptitude or his talent, but I think this is a story ultimately about PR, and I think in the end, Charleston is going to do just fine.
But I will say this. It's not that the Husk was just a PR thing. I mean, it blew up outside of Charleston because of that.
Yep.
But it was such a different restaurant in the sense, and it really changed Charleston dining in the sense that all the things we're talking about that like Frank Lee and Mike Lotta and all these guys were doing, Hussar took all of that and rolled it all together and just doubled down on it. And, you know,
and again, back to the PR and asked for credit for it. Yeah, put the chalkboard up or whatever the board was.
But when it hit, it really shook up the Charleston dining scene.
Oh, yeah.
The old fine dining places that used to pack them in, suddenly found themselves struggling to compete. A lot of there had been a lot of, I won't name names, but, you know, very expensive places where you drop $200 for a dinner for two, you know, and all that. It ended up closing their doors not long after because people found them stodgy and boring. They didn't want to go sit in the velvet chairs and have the waiters in ties and all that kind of stuff come out. And, you know, it was in the wake of Huss that the Upper King Street developed, as basically block by block, these new restaurants would open up, and they weren't super – they were that new form of fine dining where it's a little more casual, menus on clipboards, all that kind of stuff, very focused on hyper-local ingredients and fish and all that and technique and all that, not so much on luxury and, you know, the elegant dinner and all that.
Right. In the wake of Brock leaving, I am curious what's going to happen with that tasting counter because a tasting counter, more than any other restaurant format, is about the chef.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. It's the chef's table.
It's because you're like, I just want to understand this person's vision. I mean, this is the artiste sort of approach to dining. And the guy who's in charge now, they hired a couple months ago and he hasn't really done anything before that. So if there's any fallout in terms of like restaurants closing, I'd put my money on that one. Yeah. If they can't pull it off with Sean's name on top, I don't know how this guy is going to bring him in.
Yeah.
But maybe he's going to be brilliant.
Maybe
we should go.
Well, we definitely should.
Yeah, we should definitely go. I would
try that out.
Yeah.
Maybe what they need to do is come up with a entirely Southern tasting concept. Is that what the problem is? Is that people didn't want to go to one if they could go to something similar in a bigger city?
I think also in some ways the era of that tasting menu has faded. If you can just watch how like the McCrady's room format changed.
Right.
They started with like following the Alaneo whatever ticket system. In fact, they used the same ticketing program, ticketing platform. You had to buy a ticket for a certain time, and you went, and you had dinner on our terms, and you have two seatings a night, and they went to, okay, but we'll shift that. No more tickets. You pay after the meal, and then we'll move it around. And you, okay, maybe you could switch up this and that, because people I don't think as many diners are willing to just go, you know, submit themselves to the chef's control anymore.
We've talked about tasting menus a lot, I feel like. But they do say in on the coast now, it seems like it may be back on an upswing. So I don't know. But what is important about that restaurant, it was our only tasting menu only restaurant. So
is that right? I think that's right.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the other ones that did have that format, like I think Cypress Restaurant had, you know, they had a la carte, but you could also do that.
Charleston Grill still has one.
It's closed down. Charleston Grill will still do the
In Daco has one.
Yeah, so. there are a number of restaurants,
but there's no tasting menu only.
Correct. Yeah,
that one's. I'd like to see that come back around. I'm a big fan of it, even though I can see from a commercial point of view. I loved going to them. I don't do that very, very often. Right. So I think that's the problem. You can't get people in for that more than once a year. Well, we don't want to look forever backwards. It Charles, as much fun as that is. As we say, and Brock had actually, in effect, moved on several years ago. But you were writing recently about some other movements that have been happening in Charleston, which I think are interesting, and probably speak a little bit more toward the future of Charleston, because that's one I've been scratching my head about for a while is, okay, we sort of know what Husk was and how that blew up, and then we've been sort of floundering around a little bit. In recent months, really, I guess in the past year or two, there was a notable rise of female executive chefs in Charleston. So the demographics of the kitchen have been changing. But I think you wrote recently that has started to maybe shift the other way a little bit.
Right. So what happened this week is Madison Tessner, who is the executive chef of Miller's All Day, which I think is a project we've talked about on the podcast.
We talked about the breakfast all day concept,
right,
and the breakfast cocktails.
Right. And it was co-owned by Greg Johnsman of Geechee Boy Mill. So that may have come up as well. So the idea, and thirdly, that this was going to sort of revive that down by Broad Street area.
Yeah, because they're
nearly on the corner.
Yeah, that part of it, the sort of it's south down toward the Battery.
Low King.
Yeah, not a lot of fine dining down there.
No. And they weren't aiming for fine dining.
I thought it was actually fine dining. Like even
ambitious dining. Yeah, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, because it was one of those restaurants. It's not super fine dining, but it's not just a cafe, right? You know, they aim for a little bit.
Well, it was never clear. Oh. Have you eaten there?
No, I've not. We just talked
anyways,
about it.
I think that was the problem. Okay. So you never really could tell what it was supposed to be. Anyhow, Madison Tessner was asked to leave recently because the owners don't want to talk about personnel issues. Understandably, there are obviously legal implications. But according to her social media posts, she felt that she was being penalized for being outspoken. In other words, she said she behaved in a way that would be tolerated by men, that had a male chef expressed his concerns about the restaurant's direction, it would have been seen as valuable input. When she gave her concerns, they said, you gotta go. Again, that's how she tells it. Now, we can come back to that. But anyways, we had Stephanie Barner write this up. And in reading, okay, she's leaving. I thought, my goodness, she's not the first, is she? And I started counting. And we are now at half the number of female chefs we had at the start of the year.
Yeah, less than 8 months, right?
Right, which was heralded by both City Paper and I believe our paper. I think Stephanie also wrote a story like, it's the time has come. And I just feel like an idiot for for signing off on that, because I mean, anyway, so among the chefs who have left this year were Amalia Scatena from Goat Sheep Cow, Eric Caspier from Basic Kitchen, Emily Schittenhover at Felix, there were a couple more.
Chelsea Conrad.
As I wrote, they've gone for various reasons. Yeah. Some of these are very happy departures. You know, Chelsea's moving along with her career, like, in really great ways. So it was not that she wasn't up to the task or anything like that. So I don't know. But the fact is, numbers are down, way down. So by my count, we're now down to, we have three female executive chefs.
Executive chef title.
Correct. With the executive chef title, as you were saying, at Goat Sheep Cow, Amalia was replaced by another woman, but was given the title of kitchen manager.
And Goat Sheep Cow is a little bit different. It's not really a fine dining restaurant or anything. It's more of a cheese shop.
Fine dining. They wanted to develop it into more of a full-fledged restaurant. Yeah. That was the reason they hired Amalia in the first place. And I think those plans kind of, you know, got thrown out of whack with her departure. Yeah.
And then I know Michelle Weaver is still leading the Charleston Grill.
Yes.
Has been for years.
Stalwart.
So she's been there for—
SC Chef Ambassador now, I believe. Yeah.
Jill Mathias is at Chez New. And then Emily Hahn, recently, she was
at Warehouse.
And now she's at The Getaway.
Correct.
So she's still leading a kitchen. She was on Top Chef, so sort of got a lot of attention for that.
But we should say, if we're mentioning The Getaway, it was opened by a male and female partners, and the woman left very unhappily.
Oh, so, I didn't.
Yeah. so I don't know.
Didn't know that part.
As a success story for women. It is.
The numbers are one up, one down.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yep. So I guess that, I don't know, is your, like, I just noticed that from the articles. Like, oh, I didn't really think about all the departures. Is
that's
that a trend of some sort? Is there anything, or just sort of a random coincidence, or
I don't think it could be random. Yeah. Do you? I don't think it could be.
Now, with Madison Tessner, I know that one of the things that I think I saw on the various social media and things about it was not just being outspoken, but I think it was also sounded like the owners wanted to shift away from the breakfast concept and more toward being an evening restaurant, or is
they
a vice
say
person?
That's not the case.
They say it's not the case.
Yep, she did. Now, who knows what happened behind the scenes? Obviously, now that she's gone, they probably, I mean, they can say whatever they want. So I don't, that's a he said, she said, and I don't know what's really happening there.
So does it look like, if you're looking to the future, it's Charleston's going to be the great bastion of female-led kitchen?
I mean, anyone in HR can tell you this. Anyone in it's not just hiring people. You have to change the environment. And what I'm getting from all these various assorted stories is the environment is still not good for female executive chefs in Charleston.
And I have a feeling I would carry that maybe even to chefs in Charleston in general, because I still hear a lot of chefs disagreements breaking apart, people leaving on bad terms, often involving differences in opinion about which direction to take a restaurant and that kind of stuff. And it's a tough business, but at the same time, it seems like you know, you want to have an environment where you can work that through with your business partners and not have it become a
right. Well, I mean, know, in some ways, I think the departure of the woman who owned or co-owned the Getaway is actually most concerning. I think what we need more than female executive chefs are female restaurant owners. Yeah. I mean, these chefs, none of them are leaving to open their own place.
Yeah, that's just what I ask of the ones that we you listed. Where have they moved on to different things? Where are they heading?
I don't know.
No, no. It's not like they've announced I'm setting off and I got hired in New York.
Chelsea was headed to Israel when she left immediately. Oh, okay. So she's on a career path, yeah. I think. So she has a path. But the path was not – I mean, look, I guess this isn't entirely true. I'm thinking now of – I mean, Cynthia Wong left Butcher and Bee, and she opened an ice cream cart.
Ice cream cart. ice cream truck, yeah.
Have you seen it? It's a cart.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. Okay. I think the goal is to get a truck ultimately, but right now
– Oh, I thought – maybe I saw – yeah, I heard her – she was on a podcast talking about maybe the truck. Maybe they're working on the truck.
Right, I believe they're working on the truck, but currently she has a cart. And, I mean, you don't get more modest than that. I mean, that is like, you know, a 19th century peddler. I mean, that is not like – which doesn't mean the food isn't. I think what she's doing is fantastic, but it just frustrates me as a woman. Like, that's what you aspire to? A little cart? Yeah. I don't know. I think that's what she aspires to. I'm
and
just
if,
saying,
if
like,
an individual, if that's what you want, that's totally great.
And no maybe, judgment.
It'd be great. But, you don't see all the women doing what you've seen a lot of men do in the past, which is be an executive chef somewhere and then now I'm open. I got backing and I got the financial backers and they're going to help me open this place and it's going to be mine.
And this did happen recently. Fazia Garner, who had Fazia's Afghan Kitchen, was her truck. She opened a place in Goose Creek. She's Kebab House. She's now closing Kebab House. So she was a restaurant owner, but she's closing it so she could go to doctor's appointments with her husband. Again, I'm all for love and I'm for spouses taking care of one another. But I can't think of too many men who would close their restaurant because their wife was sick and they had to go to doctor's appointments. Now I'm getting really frustrated. I guess it's just there aren't that ownership is the key. I really think that's it. And I'm
Well, as we if we back up from that to Charleston a little bit more broadly, and this is one where maybe I'm just not as much in the scene as I used to be, but it still doesn't seem to be. There's lots of dots that aren't cohering into a pattern for Charleston in the way that you know it was before. I sort of feel like you're going back. We're talking about the sort of three stages. You had, you know, the rise of the new Southern stuff, the 2006 through opening of Husk, which is really when Charleston blew up on the scene and became this super national, you know, all the food writers and the insiders, people were flying in from all over the world to eat in Charleston, and they had to eat Husk, and they had to, you know, go to the Ordinary and the Fig and these places. I feel like now Charleston has just become a destination, and everyone knows it's a great place to visit, and there's great food, but it's not like, oh, and here's these three restaurants you have to go to. It's much more like you go to Charleston, there are nice hotels downtown, there's lots of great restaurants everywhere you turn. And it's just like a destination.
Lifted. The bar is quite high, but I don't think Charleston's necessarily setting any kind of agenda. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think they're just struggling to keep up with the short staffing issue and all of that. I just had someone in town from a national publication who's come here doing research for Best New Restaurants. I was like, I don't know where to take you. I mean, which doesn't mean that I haven't thoroughly enjoyed some of our new restaurants. But when you think of it in the national scheme to say, oh, my God, you better hop on a plane if you're living in Denver and check out whatever. I don't know if we're out in front that way right now. Again, doesn't mean the food's bad.
Oh, no, it's sort of like there are very, very many great restaurants and people ask where to eat. I said, well, there's so many options and there really are.
And my frustration, I was like, why are you here for new restaurants? Like, why do we have to go to a new restaurant? Because there are plenty of places I've been here 3 years, 5 years, 8 years that I'd love to take you, you know, but that's all I got.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I want to have some, here's where the pendulum is swinging. It's going back some other way. And now that we see these trends coming, I just don't see it right now other than there being, I think it's going to, the dynamics are not great with the real estate. The more and more and more, as we look out the window here, we can see buildings going up right across the street, apartment complexes and hotels and downtown. And I think it's just going to drive up the cost, the real estate. Staffing makes it even harder to run it. So it's going to lead to, I think, these high-end tourist dollar restaurants. But it doesn't seem like an environment that's conducive to – the kind of sort of frenetic energy or creative energy that we had in 2006, 2007 when Brock sort of put down his roots here. But not to end on a completely down note for the future, because I think there's something really interesting that on the horizon for Charleston, and that's the African American Museum, which is slated to open. Is it 2020 now? It's slated to open up its doors.
I think it's trying for that.
Okay, they're underway. For a long time, it was like raising money, and they've gotten, I think, over that hurdle. They haven't.
Well, they're still accepting money.
Oh, they're still taking money, but they got enough to move on to
the. They're going to begin construction.
Yeah, they're about to begin construction. They have an executive director. They you know they're getting it going. So that might be an interesting twist. It's going to be down right near the aquarium on the harbor. If you've been to Charleston, so right there on the water in a, I don't know, that's not the primest location for foot traffic right now, but I think it will become much more of a magnet. Already the aquarium draws people, but then there's a little bit of a hole there where you have to, there's not a lot else around it.
Right, there is, but it'll be interesting too as they continue to develop the water taxi and there's more traffic on the water. I think I can
It could really being. Shift. Yep. It's definitely draw a lot more people down there in addition to who's already going to the aquarium. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely going to be a draw. But, you know, that's one thing for drawing tourists, but what about food? Right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's been some of the interesting news because, well, you wrote about this. So refresh your memory, they announced their plans, but that wasn't quite. This is super ambitious.
Well,
as
you say
might
they
think.
Announced their plans, they answered my question.
There was an announcing plan. So you asked.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I was curious because, I mean, it seems to me that Charleston obviously has an international culinary reputation at this point. And they're telling the story of, you know, African American people. So food is very woven into the story of any people. And it certainly informs the way we eat here. So there seemed to be both, there seemed to be a number of reasons why they would be thinking about food at this institution. And they have thought about food. They know people could get hungry. But it really, as it turns out, is that there's no space to put it. It comes down to square footage, and they have made the decision to devote as much of it as they can to interpretation. And not sort of the, interpretation-ishy stuff where you're having, fried chicken and that leads you to understand about. Anyway, they want exhibit space is what it comes down to. Yeah. So the plan currently is to have some grab-and-go, maybe sandwiches or things inside the museum. There's some discussion that could be framed in such a way that it recalls the tradition of African-American just shoebox lunches, what you would have been traveling with, the idea being, of course, in the Jim Crow South, you don't know where you can get a meal. You might be stuck in a city without, where it's only whites-only restaurants or there's no boarding house that will accommodate you. So maybe. But anyways, it's grab and go is the phrase they're using. And then outside, they hope to get some food trucks set up.
Yeah. Which does seem to me like, and of course, it's not 2020 yet. There's time to adjust. The museum is not, it's not focused just on Charleston. It's the African-American history of, in the
Correct.
Country
the
as a whole.
International. Okay. It's a diaspora.
It's African diaspora. Okay. Yep. So it's more than just even the United States.
Yep.
So that's one thing. But Charleston is such a locus of where African food came first to the North America and then so much just sort of underlies everything here from rice to okra and gumbo or okra soup or gumbo to the red beans. I mean, just about everything that is the sort of foundation of Charleston cooking has its roots in some way or another on the African continent.
And not only is the setting appropriate, but obviously museum dining has changed so much recently that it's now a visitor expectation, in fact.
Well, we talked about this a while back about various museums. And there was a time when, the museum had a little cafe, every museum had a little cafe somewhere which sold sandwiches and quick take just because some people needed to eat and, they didn't want you to have to necessarily leave and go find a restaurant somewhere else. So it was just sort of a convenience. Like they had restrooms and water fountains. Right. So there's a little cafe where you can get something to eat. But more and more restaurant or more and more museums are now starting to build things around food.
And absolutely. And in writing about this, I talked to the Gibbs here in town, the art museum, that prior to their recent renovation didn't have any sort of dining service or nothing that you would think of. And they created a whole cafe space because they had been asked by so many guests. I mean, it's part of, too, people want to spend a little bit more time at the museum, maybe not just looking at a diorama, but sort of in the space, reflecting on the lessons they're learning. It's a time for conversation about what you've seen, and it all feels very, you know, thematic and on point. Visitors want these places. So their cafe space is now run by The Daily. It's The Daily at the Gibbs.
Oh, really? I didn't know they were in that.
Yep. Okay. So they've moved in, and it has been so successful that The Daily, true to its name, said, well, we need to open on Mondays. The Gibbs has never opened on Mondays, but The Daily is Daily. So they said, yeah.
We're The Daily except Monday.
Right, exactly. We're going to have to open so you can come in. Okay. So many people have come in because they like to eat in a museum space that now the museum opens on Mondays. This has happened three weeks ago.
For the food and then maybe get some art.
The museum thought, why not? And so they have completely adjusted their opening schedule based on the success of dining.
I really like the idea that instead of taking a cafe and then giving it to some industrial food service company that runs these things here in Seattle and, you know, Tucson, give it to a local restaurant that's going to be able to do something different.
You know?
And it's something that's more a little locally rooted and unique. So if you're coming to visit Charleston, you can go to the museum. It can also have something that is local here. That's where I think with the African American History Museum, there's so much – or African American Museum. Is it History Museum?
It's called the International African American Museum. That's the official name. Okay. So – and I in their defense, two things I ought to say. One, we talked about at the African American Museum in D.C., the Smithsonian, when it opened, Sweet Home Cafe got a tremendous amount of attention. And literally, if you took that food court and you had – four of them, that would be bigger than the whole museum here. Yeah. So it's not like they have a lot of space. They're not going to devote that much space. Okay, so I understand that. And they would say, too, that the food trucks would be local. That would be the idea. And also, you know, what the director says is, well, you know, we're going to get people excited about food and we're going to send them to go find it. Mm-hmm. Now, that is part of a museum's mission, is that things should end at the door. You should have people give them a reason to invest in the community, the wider community. But, like, we've all heard rumors about various chefs who would like to be very involved in this museum. And I really wish there was an opportunity for them to be so.
Well, it's not over yet.
It's not over yet.
They're raising funds, so maybe with enough funds, they could get a little extra room. I'm not sure what the land limitations are over there.
Right.
I really hope, though, because that is one part of Charleston that has potential. But you mentioned the water taxi. There's a water taxi that goes from Patriots Point over on the Mount Pleasant side of the harbor over to landing right there next to the aquarium on this side. But the problem is you get out, you can go to the aquarium. But if you want to go anywhere else, it's a good mile and a half walk from there through just, you know, some of it's neighborhoods, but a lot of it's just sort of like these streets along a field and near the harbor port and stuff like that. So it's not even an attractive walk. If you could get some more energy over there and some restaurants and other things built up around it, then that would really make for a really interesting neighborhood.
Right. That's exactly right. So maybe it's not on the premises. Maybe it's something in the area. Yeah. I don't know exactly.
A standalone building nearby,
right? Because even if people's interests are piqued, if you're a tourist, you're probably not going to go straight to Bertha's because, I mean, you could call an Uber, but I'm guessing most folks...
No, I've done it. When I was in London, we ate in the British Museum I didn't want to leave, I was hungry.
And... Exactly. My guess is that tourists will go to the museum and then they're going to go back downtown. So it would be really nice to have something on site.
Yeah, that's true. And if you're in Charleston, if you're going over to that area and you're staying downtown, it's a hike. So you're going to a different part of the town. You may even be taking a taxi or an Uber or something. So yeah, let's give them something to eat. So we'll leave it there as like a little seed for maybe the Charleston's future because that could help push us in a particular way and one that looks much more to the city's culinary heritage. So that would be an exciting turn of events, I would think.
That is all all for this edition of The Winnow. We recorded today's episode in the Equal Opportunity Podcasting Studios at the Post and Courier Building in downtown Charleston, South Carolina. If you enjoy listening to The Winnow, help other listeners find us too. Just go to iTunes, SoundCloud, or wherever you access your podcasts and like us or leave a rating. The Winnow is a production of the Post and Courier and Palmetto New Media. Our producer today was the chefy J. Emery Parker. Our theme music is by the Bluestone Ramblers.
Until next time, I'm Robert Moss.
I'm Hannah Raskin.
Now get out there and eat.